We have become, I think, a society very intolerant to negative emotion. We have been taught that we need to be happy at all the time. Yeah. You know, like at any cost.
And we have social media that re-accentuates that.
Because everything you see is only positive. People are happy and they're posting about how happy they are and how...
no one is crying on Instagram.
No one's crying and how they have amazing relationships and like the husband is madly in love with them and all of that. So you're constantly bombarded with that. So you have the inner pressure to always be happy, which is impossible.
Very performative, yeah.
Welcome once again to The Lighthouse Conversations, a podcast featuring entrepreneurs and tastemakers from the world of art, culture, tech, and of course, food. I'm your host, Hesham Montasser, founder of The Lighthouse. You might remember us addressing mental health issues a couple of weeks ago in our special Behind the Scenes episode. In fact, with COVID-19, it does feel like people are more open to discussing their vulnerabilities and struggles with mental health. Now, this struggle is not something that started just because of COVID, and neither will it end with COVID. But the fact that these conversations are more open is definitely a positive takeaway. And that's the theme for today's episode with our guest, Dr. Karin Elkhazen, a clinical psychologist with the American Center of Psychiatry and Neurology and VP of the Middle East Eating Disorders Association. I'll be talking to her about the impact of COVID-19 on us, as well as a deep dive into her area of expertise, food disorders, and the associated mental health trends she sees in this part of the world. But we're starting with Lebanon. As you know, the explosion on August 4 continues to impact Beirut and the Lebanese people. And I was curious to get Dr. Karin's take, both as someone with close ties to the city, but also as a mental health practitioner.
The situation, as you know, is extremely sad and difficult. I don't think it's the explosion per se. I think it's the accumulation of traumas. So I think since October of last year, Lebanese people have been going through ongoing traumas. So first there was the Thawra, and then after that the economic crisis, and then COVID, and then the explosion, and then COVID again. So I think they are really
They're tired.
And how resilient can you be when you're constantly bombarded with, you know, that's one slap after the other? So I think in general, Lebanese people are very resilient
100%.
In general. But sometimes resilience can be bad because then you adapt to maybe abnormal situations and you take it as your new normal. So this is I think the danger and where we should be careful to use what happened in a positive way and not to adapt to it, but to read more as a drive for change.
It's obviously a very complicated situation. So if I understand you correctly, one of the things you're saying is part of being so flexible and adaptive to situations means they're willing to settle for less.
They could adapt to a situation that's abnormal. This is part of resilience. You know, when you're resilient, you adapt to difficult situations. And I'm not saying it's happening, but I'm saying this could be the danger. So the idea now is to move forward. And I think they are. I think they are coping in a positive way. I think they're very, very adamant at rebuilding.
Yes.
So you see all these youth on the streets cleaning up and building and all those NGOs who are doing an incredible job on the ground. And I had a conversation last week when I was there with a fellow psychologist, and she was telling me how difficult it is for a mental health professional to support others when you are going through your own trauma. And she was telling me the way I'm coping is to move forward. So all the plans that I had, the trainings, I'm moving on. You know, I'm not saying this is the end. So I'm continuing to look at the future and to build a future. So I think it's a nice coping mechanism to keep going.
So how are you coping? Because obviously, I mean, exactly to your point right now, I mean, you are a psychologist. You deal with patients all day, every day. But this is very close to your heart, as you said. Big part of your identity, clearly.
So first, just a disclaimer, no matter how difficult it is to me, I cannot pretend it's anything close to what the Lebanese people are living, because I'm not there and I have the privilege to be of being safe in a very supportive country with an income, etc., which a lot of people don't have. So,
but you have family there.
But of course, I'm extremely attached to Lebanon, and I'm very sad, and I have all my families there, all my friends are there. And since October of last year, this has been a difficult year for me in general, because I'm so close to Lebanon and everything that's happening there. Even though, as again, disclaimer, I cannot pretend to be affected as much as them. So I think I think my coping mechanism is my routine, is to continue, you know, having a routine, exercising, working hours, a schedule. Even with COVID, all of that has been disrupted. And I tried as much as possible for me and my family to continue a normal routine of waking up, of exercising, of when homeschooling was there, homeschooling, then going to work and trying to, you know, socialize remotely and then less remotely later on. So to continue a normal life as much as possible, then I use all the positive psychology tools, which I find amazing. Like, so when I wake up in the morning, I try not to grab my phone.
Yes, we all try that. But
I try to have 5 minutes where either I meditate or I do some gratitude. Then if it's the day where I exercise, I try to straight go to exercising mildly. You know, exercise can be very positive. For me, it's very positive, but for people who struggle with exercise addiction, this is not something I would recommend. But with someone who doesn't have a problem, exercise is always positive, because it does produce endorphins and it helps you, you know, be in the moment as well. And maintaining, you know, very regular routines at home with mealtime, you know, with the kids, sleeping time. We tried as much as possible to continue throughout this period.
And how did you explain this to them when the explosion happened? Obviously, you know, their family members could be exposed, to put it mildly. How would you explain to them as children, because of various ages, obviously?
Yes, of various ages. And the tricky part was that I was flying there a couple of days later. Right. I had to postpone after the explosion. So it was a very, very intense moment at home, because already prior to this explosion, I had an argument with my husband regarding me going. He didn't want me to go. And I was, we were like not fighting, but arguing around me going, not going. So basically, when it happened, him and the kids were like completely starting to yell at me, and you want to go to Lebanon with the situation, and crying, and you're not allowed to go. And it was very, very, very traumatic. So I calmed them down and I told them I'm not going to go now. And then we sat and we started. I started explaining to them a bit Lebanon and you know, the situation and the historically and all of that. And we started to think how we can help.
That's true.
I think it's very important, specifically for children, to feel that
they can do something.
They can do something, specifically from a distance. It can be very frustrating when you're far away. This is one of my biggest frustrations, not to be able to be on the ground helping with my tools. So I'm a psychologist, I'm trauma trained, I think I can have an added value, but I'm here, so I can't be everywhere. So my eldest started posting on social media, you know, a lot on Lebanon, and she felt
It's her way
posting NGOs, etc. Then we did boxes that we sent to Lebanon. So I got them to give stuff that they were not using anymore. Then I involved them in donations, things like that. So
Have cousins or friends their age that they, at least your eldest, that she connects with?
They have friends in Lebanon, so they're getting feedback from their friends in Lebanon. Okay. And doing a good job at reposting everything that's happening. And till today, my daughter told me yesterday, Mom, you're not posting enough on Lebanon. You know, people are going to forget. People should not forget. So I think it's nice of her. So I try to involve them in everything I'm doing for Lebanon, and I think they feel useful.
And on that note, are there any, because we also get this question and like our listeners to have the benefit if they want to help, are there particular NGOs or places that you can recommend to us for people that want to help, whether financially or in other ways?
Yeah, sure. I think there are a lot of amazing NGOs, and if I don't mention them now, it doesn't mean they're not good. But
we'll put it in the show notes, even if you remember a name later.
The first thing to know is not to donate to the government, and really to donate to NGOs, so non-governmental organizations.
Sure.
Lebanese Red Cross is always a good idea because they're doing an amazing job on the ground. Beit al-Baraka was initially an initiative to open free supermarkets for elderly people who didn't have the means, you know, to buy. So now they've expanded their work. They're rebuilding houses, and they're helping a lot. There is Offre Joie also, who's working on the ground. Arc-en-Ciel also. There is a lot. There is Embrace, which is the suicide hotline, which is also an NGO doing a lot for mental health. So they're always in need of donations and volunteer psychologists who can give up their time.
That's great. That's very helpful. Thank you. You were a school psychologist for a number of years, for about 8 years in your previous life. So you have, and you still obviously through your practice, have a lot of interaction with children and parents that have to deal with children every day, and you are a parent of three yourself. I'm curious, and I'm a father myself of two children, especially during COVID. In some cases, you see signs that the child is not okay, but in many cases, they seem okay, and then parents were surprised to start seeing their kids, quote-unquote, act up, and they don't know what to do. So I want to ask you, first question is, to tell us a little bit how you see how COVID has affected children. I'm obviously aware that different ages will be different, so we're generalizing a little bit, but I want to get your opinion on this. And secondly, specifically for parents, what are signs they should be looking out for where the line moves from I have to talk or spend more time with my child to I should give him professional help?
It's a fine line, absolutely. So first, unfortunately, we do not know yet the effects of COVID on children and adults, because what we're seeing now is some effect, but I predict, unfortunately, that the mental health effects are going to be for years to come after COVID. And I think the post-COVID is going to be worse than the COVID. So I think from a mental health perspective, we are going to pay the price
after. Because maybe now many of us are in this fight or flight mode.
Yes.
And that's going to go, and then you're going to process.
Yes. And I think the biggest trigger now is for people in general is not knowing when this is going to end.
Yes.
Because so this uncertainty creates a lot of anxiety. But I think that in the future, we are going, and I always say that from the beginning, to pay the price of COVID-19 in terms of mental health for years to come after COVID-19, unfortunately.
So can we classify this for at least most people as a trauma?
Yes, it is traumatic. And why is it traumatic? Because it hit the most important aspect of humans, which is human interaction. So if you remember the longest study on happiness that Harvard Medical School did over 75 years, they found that the most important component was meaningful social relationships. So COVID-19 is changing that and is isolating us. And already before that, we were a bit isolated because of our devices and electronics. Now it took another, you know, dimension. So I think this is the biggest problem with COVID-19, not the anxiety linked to the disease or catching it or all of that. Okay, there's a bit of that, but it's mostly the disconnect. And as human beings, we are social animals. Zoom cannot replace it. I mean, it's better than nothing, fine, but it cannot replace it. And teens need this connection. The problem with homeschooling or distance learning, because it's different, is not the content of school. At school, it's not the academic content. This, you can get it. It's the whole socializing aspect. When you go to school, you learn social skills. You learn how to interact. You learn how to work in a group. You learn how to be tolerant. You learn how to listen to other people's opinions. And all of that is crucial in personality building. That's why I don't believe that distance learning can ever replace, not for now, you know, the proper school environment. So I think this is the biggest problem with COVID-19, though I don't argue with lockdowns or anything. I think
sure.
they were there for a reason, and social distancing is very important, you know, to because we know nothing of this
about
pandemic,
the disease,
right?
Yeah.
So how do we know that the child needs professional help or is just acting out? Because also, you know, what I'd like to say is that kids are very resilient, much more than adults, and they adapt to difficult situations and a bit of hostile environments easier than us. They're more flexible, they're more elastic. So it is normal for a child or a teen to react to a change in his life. So we don't jump and pathologize and say he has a mental health problem and he needs to see someone. It would be, I think it's more abnormal for a child not to react at all because that would mean that maybe he's suppressing something and something's not happening. So if a child is reacting as in maybe having a bit more anxiety or maybe
withdrawing,
spending more times on
right.
On,
so
on
older
devices.
Children, I mean, my children are young, but from friends that have older children, I heard a lot that, yeah, that already they're on devices, so they have kind of, that has gone higher.
Yes, so all of that is unfortunately kind of normal. Of course, we should not give in to it, and we should continue as parents our fight on anti-device as much as possible.
But it's hard, right, when you're 6 months into it.
But it's hard.
And to your point, you don't know the ending point. So one thing is if I know, oh, you know what, it's like, you know, I'm fasting, and I know there's an end
there's
versus
an end.
An indefinite. That's the issue.
Yes, it's hard, and then it will create more, you know, arguments at home. But we need to have the same speech. We need to have the speech that we want to talk to you. We want to be, you know, in interaction with you. We don't want you to be behind your device all the time. Now, when is the time to seek professional help, whether for children, adults, or adolescents? It's the level of impairment. So really, when the teen or the child or the adult is not functioning well anymore, so when his daily life is impaired, so the sleep is impaired, the appetite is impaired, there's apathy, there is, you know, withdrawal, but complete withdrawal, even the daily activities of maybe walking around the house or whatever he doesn't want to do anymore.
These are warning signals.
Out. Yes, specifically if they are enduring, so if they endure in time. Then definitely this is the time where you should seek help.
Okay.
Because or a child who constantly complains, specifically for children more than for teens, of physical pains, because children don't have the capacity to verbalize the way teens or adults do. So they will have a tendency to translate everything in their bodies. So if you have constant stomach cramps or pains or constant, you know, headaches or things like that, this is a sign to keep in mind.
I had found in the earlier months of this that creating a semblance of a routine, even at home, was very important. As you said earlier, creating these
anchors
and kind of moments of tranquility of sorts, whether it's through meditation or breathing exercise or all of the above. And I have to say, at least personally, a lot of these things, certainly the meditative aspect, didn't come naturally to me. So I had to sort of push myself and practice. But as I did it, it became easier and easier and more, a bit like exercise, something I started looking forward to. Would you prescribe generally as routine as a good thing to try?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, any positive psychology, any meditation, any breathing, it could be a couple, it could be praying for some people.
Sure.
Any moment during the day where you are with your own self, because we are bombarded all the time, you know, with our devices, we're no longer on our own. We're constantly in interaction. Again, doing it randomly won't work. The thing that will work is really to create a routine. It's just like exercise. It becomes ingrained in your system. You know, there's something called the neuroplasticity of the brain cells. When you brush your teeth in the morning, you don't think about it. You just do it automatically. So if you can try to put exercise and meditation, breathing in that kind of routine, it will be with time easier for you, for sure. And for children as well, I think to disconnect them from devices, you know, the good old board games, Are very helpful because it's a time where all the devices are away and you're talking with your child and you're playing a board game, so there's no devices. And it's a time where they're focused. It's mindfulness. They're focused on
the game. Yes.
Family meals are crucial. I can't, stress enough the importance of them. So also it's a time where they're disconnected and you're talking to you. Specifically with your teens, it's a time where so much is happening and they want to tell you very little. So if there's no connection, no place to be able to communicate, you most likely won't know what's happening. And this is when, it's not about being intrusive, but just keeping the communication lines open. So family meals, board games, going for a walk all together, even if it's 10, 15 minutes, these are very good ways to keep the communication going.
We'll be back to talk more about the side effects of the lockdowns and get into food disorders with Dr. Karin after this short break. Hey guys, if you want to know other ways you could contribute to the Lebanese people directly, you might also want to check out our episode with Zeynep Dana. It was episode number 20, and there's a link in our show notes. And if you're tuning in from Dubai, you might have noticed the weather slowly cooling down, so we've opened our terrace at the Lighthouse in D3 for everyone who would like to enjoy a sunny breakfast or dinner al fresco with a Burj Khalifa view. Speaking of dinner, make use of our current promotion called Sail the Mediterranean. For 200 dirham, you'll get to have a starter, main and dessert with two alcoholic beverages. You can book a table directly on our Instagram or FB accounts. Welcome back. You're listening to the Lighthouse Conversations with Dr. Karin Elkhazen. Before the break, I was speaking to her about the impact of COVID-19 on us as communities and how it has created a trauma that required professional mental health support in many cases, because the impact goes beyond just the health scares or the general uncertainty. One example of an unexpected and unintended consequence of the lockdown period was the rise in cases of domestic violence.
At the beginning, people were saying, that's great, now parents and kids will be together and couples will be reunited because parents can travel. But sometimes the equilibrium of a family is based on the parent traveling because the parent cannot cope with family life and has anger issues that are not resolved, not solved. So the way this family is surviving is basically because one of the two parents is not there. First, the family has to readjust. If they can readjust, the person who has the issues, maybe it's multiple persons or maybe it's the dynamic that's problematic, is likely to result into problems. So distance is not necessarily bad. In some cases, it's protective for the kids and for the other parent. So we've seen a lot of traumas now arise from this proximity.
But when you are undergoing a situation like that, it's very hard to... I mean, you're not obviously aware of the fact that this is traumatic as you go on. From a kind of a personal experience, 10 years ago or so, my mother passed away. And it was a very, very difficult for me personally. It was a year that was highly traumatic. She went in and out of treatment, etc., etc. During that period, I was just trying to cope. And obviously developed a number of probably destructive habits as coping mechanisms. But only many years later was I able to go and look back, realize the trauma involved, the traumatic events that happened, and trying to process it. I don't know if you take me back 10 years during that moment, during that year, when we were trying to keep her alive, essentially, whether I would have been able to embed anything to deal with my trauma, if you see what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
The reason I'm using this example, because it's a very personal example for me, and I think about, I was lucky enough that during this period, it's not as traumatic as it is for others, luckily, although we all have our own sense of anxiety. But while you're in it, how do people, deal with it and develop coping mechanisms that are not destructive? It's very, very difficult to do. 2 years from now, maybe they'll be able to come to you as a professional and say, you know what, it was a very difficult time. How can you help me? But as we speak today, what can they do?
The first thing I want to say is whatever anyone did to survive, respect. Even if it was destructive,
that's great.
It was just a way to survive. So even eating disorders, even addictions, and I'm, of course, I'm not, you know, encouraging anyone to go down that route. But when patients come to me because they feel so judged, you know, that they've
done this.
You're saying
be gentle on yourself.
Yeah, be gentle on yourself.
Okay, that's a very important point.
You were trying to find a solution. You went to the wrong solution, which eventually made things worse for you.
Yes.
But initially, you were trying to find a solution. No one goes on an addiction path or an eating disorder, you know, wanting to consciously harm themselves.
Yeah.
They're trying to find a solution and
they're trying to
stay afloat. And some people are not equipped to, you know, at the time to do differently. And this is the way they found to survive. So I think we need to be gentle with ourselves and as a society, not to be, you know, not to judge people who went down that route. I think it's very important. There's a lot of stigma attached to those behaviors, and I think it's important to always remember that this was someone who was trying to cope.
He did it
the wrong way, but he was trying to cope.
Sure.
So definitely the first thing I'd like to remind everyone is those quick fixes don't work in the long term. It numbs you. Maybe it makes you, function for the time being. But eventually, it's gonna come back.
Catches up with you.
It catches up, and it makes everything so much worse. We have become, I think, a society very intolerant to negative emotion. We have been taught that we need to be happy at
all the time. Yeah.
You know, like at any cost.
And we have social media that re-accentuates that.
Because everything you see is only positive. People are happy and they're posting about how happy they are and how...
no one is crying on Instagram.
No one's crying and how they have amazing relationships and like the husband is madly in love with them and all of that. So you're constantly bombarded with that. So you have the inner pressure to always be happy, which is impossible.
It's very performative, yeah.
It's impossible to be happy all the time. And in our human condition, we are bound to have negative emotion. And we should not try to get rid of it because it historically kept us alive. If you didn't have the fight, flight, freeze, faint reaction, if you didn't have the anxiety that triggered those four, I'm giving just anxiety as an example.
Sure.
Those four behaviors, those four reactions, our species would have been extinct.
Yes.
So clearly our negative emotions tell us that something is wrong, that something needs to be changed, that you need to, you know, change something, maybe have someone get out of your life, or maybe change a behavior, or maybe change something that you're doing that's not working for you in terms of your values. Your negative emotion always tells you something about your values. So instead of trying to get rid of them, and this is easier said than done, I'm still practicing today.
All of us,
but trying to accept that negative emotions are part of life and trying to build some tolerance to them and try to practice self-soothing things, which are not going to be as effective as drinking or starving or binging or all of that in the short term, but at least that won't be destructive in the long term and that won't pull you away from your values.
And I think that gets us to the core of your expertise, which is eating disorder. So obviously you've seen all sorts of cases over the years. This is something that's clearly misunderstood. The stigma there is maybe even higher than other mental diseases,
absolutely,
right? So for some reason, people are willing to, I'm not saying tolerate, but maybe feel less stigma with someone who is depressed or bipolar. But when it comes to disorders, especially food, this is highly stigmatized. It has been accentuated with social media, where today we have, you know, from the snap filters that beautify
TikTok.
Women, TikTok, etc. So young women especially vulnerable. Men and women, of course, but I'm using girls as I think it's an extremely vulnerable segment because of the emphasis on how they look.
Specifically in our region.
So that was my first question. So is it more, do you see that more so here in our region than elsewhere in the world?
I think eating disorders are a pandemic. You know, in general, the rates have been rising exponentially in the last 10 years. Maybe it has tripled. So
I'm sorry to interrupt you. And I read in one of your interviews, you had said that the mortality rate with eating disorders is higher than almost any other mental disease.
Yes.
That's something, can you?
So in adults and adolescents, till last year, it was the number one cause of mortality.
Globally or
globally? Globally. So it's the deadliest of all mental health disorders. Now, for adults this year, it came second after opioid consumption. So opioid...
mainly the U.S.
Yes, mainly the U.S. But for adolescents, it's unfortunately still the number one cause of death. And it's the one specifically in our part of the world that's the most disregarded because it's a food issue. You know, so there's the whole thing about, you know, let her eat more or let her not eat. You know, it's like it's really disregarded. It's not considered as a real disorder. And we struggle with families when they get to us to explain, you know, how deadly it can be and how impairing it is and how, you know, how important to treat it and to treat it early.
Do they usually go together? In other words, if someone has an eating disorder, do you see cases where they are starving themselves and then binging, or is it one or the other?
It can be the three. Okay. So you can be just, if you're anorexic, restricting type, so it's just starving, but eventually either you die or you start binging to stay alive. So, you know, we have primitive bodies. If your body is normal, at one point it will start asking for food and the food obsessions will go towards binge eating. In most of the cases, eventually they start binge eating. Some of them start with starving and binging. And then you have a binge eating disorder where people just binge. And you have bulimia nervosa where people try to get rid of what they have binged on in very unhealthy and ineffective ways that in fact don't make them get rid of the calories and on the contrary turn their bodies into a fat-making machine. And this is when they come for consultation, when they start gaining weight and they realize that what they're doing is not effective.
Do you see more women than men?
I see more women than men for sure, which is in line with, you know, the world numbers.
Okay.
95% of eating disorder sufferers are young women between the age of 15 and 25. I suspect now that it's even younger because I'm seeing anorexic, you know, people suffering from anorexia as young as 11 years old, and I'm seeing a lot of them. And also I'm seeing a rising number of men coming for treatment. I don't know if it's hitting men more or if there's more awareness on this subject and people are more acceptant of seeking help for a woman's disorder. Maybe it's that. I suspect it's also linked to social media and also the objectification of men's bodies.
Yeah.
There has been quite a few studies showing, you know, how the male ideal has evolved throughout the years and how now it's this whole emphasis on muscle building. So usually the presentation is different. Men want to be bulkier. Yes. They want to be more muscly. Women want to be thinner. So men will enter eating disorders usually through going to the gym and, you know, bulking up and women through dieting usually. But in both cases, you know, the mortality rates in men are higher than women.
So what are steps that people can take? I mean, for themselves, I mean, before they come and see someone like yourself as a professional, are there certain warning signals that they're going to see? And also, I'm just curious, when it comes to the second follow-up question, treatment, is the treatment purely psychological?
Yeah, we don't have pills for eating disorders.
Yeah, so exactly.
So the treatment is mainly psychological, but we do work with, I run a multidisciplinary team with specialized dietitians, medical doctors, and psychiatrists. Because we try to tackle the problem from all angles, but the main treatment is psychological, because eating disorders are cognitive and emotional disorders.
And is something people can do at home, or they need to be seeing a professional?
There are some self-help books, depending on the severity of the case and the presentation. So if you suffer from a mild, newly developed binge eating disorder, there is a very good book called Overcoming Binge Eating from Christopher Fairburn, which is step by step,
and data
has shown that it's quite effective for simple cases of binge eating. If someone is struggling with anorexia nervosa, and specifically if it's advanced, then definitely they need professional help. Now, as a parent, when your child starts to, you know, develop some signs or show some signs, Maybe we can talk about what to do for your child to try to prevent it, even though we know that today there's a very strong genetic component.
With all mental issues or specifically anorexia.
Okay. Yes, but to be on the safe side, a couple of advices, you know, as families, I don't think anyone should ever diet. Diets don't work. They make you gain weight with time, and they are the first trigger for eating disorders. There should not be an emphasis on physical appearance, on body image, on good food, bad food. Food should not be demonized, and we should not label food.
So, sorry, Karine, to interrupt you, but I just want to push back on this. Of course, that's even. But let's just take an example here. If at home we are not emphasizing, for example, issues of body image and so on and so forth, but their friends are, on social media they all are, they're getting likes, you know, because a girl or a boy looks a certain way. How do we combat that? I mean, you tell them, you know, they all want to be liked. I mean, as teenagers, you know, it was, you know, back in the day used to have, I don't know, a nice, the latest sneakers. They're all now doing this via social media.
Very true. But what happens at home is the most important.
Okay.
So if at home you model a good body image, you don't talk about your body, you don't talk about dieting, you eat properly from everything with your children, and you don't feel sad, and you don't talk about the need to exercise to compensate for what you have eaten, you don't comment on other people's bodies, and you don't associate thinness with worth, then you're protecting your kids. Number two is to open the conversation about social media. I think parents should control their kids' social media. I might sound controversial and depending on the age, but you should know who your kid is following and what they're watching. There is a very, very worrying pro-anorexic content on TikTok. So as parents, please be careful. TikTok is really, you know, and we've...
Well, largely thanks to Trump, we might not have it in a few days, but
maybe that's the positive thing.
Didn't mean to belittle it, but
Open discussion on what they are looking at on social media. So why is it so important to have this type of body? What does it mean? What do they think that means? You know, so it's important to keep talking about those topics with them, because as a parent, you have the strongest, you know, you are the role model, you are the reference, and you have the strongest input on your kids, but do not confront them. So it's not about being, you know, no, you're wrong, because specifically teens will rebel. So they will go and do the opposite of what you say. So you have to be very
gentle.
You know, gentle and know how to approach it in a non-judgmental way. And definitely, you know, by making them think about what they're seeing, and by educating them also. I think media literacy is very important, educating them on Photoshop, on airbrushing, showing them. Dove has a great content. Dove on how
Dove
images.
The soap maker.
Yes, the soap maker. They have nice content online on Photoshop and airbrushing and real beauty. And so showing those videos to the children can be very positive. Talking about it, educating them, telling them to go and research Photoshop and airbrush, et cetera, making them aware of the image manipulations. These are all very important things.
Just on the point that you made earlier about objectifying women, I mean, even as adults, a lot of women deal with that. I mean, I wanted to hear from you a little bit from your own personal experience. I mean, you've been a professional working pretty much all your adult life. You have three children. Have you figured out a roadmap over the years?
I think, you know,
I know it's a very complex subject.
It's a very complex subject. And I have this comment, you know, because most my patients have eating disorders. I mean, not most, but half of them at least. And I have a lot of teenagers. And when we have those discussions about, you know, physical appearance and why it's so important, they tell me, but look at you. You dress up.
Exactly what I was going to ask.
So this is self-care.
No, 100%. So you get this, sorry to interrupt you. Oh, but you don't have this problem. Look at you.
Yeah,
so why
you don't have this problem. But and you emphasize on your physical appearance. You're always dressed up and you do your hair. So I explain, this is for me, this is my self-care. Showing respect to myself. This is not hiding behind, I'm not good enough, I need to always be tiré à quatre épingles, perfect.
100%.
No, this is me taking care of myself. In my hectic life, this is the half an hour where I focus on me And I kind of treat myself.
Yes.
So this is not...
this is your me time, essentially.
This is my me time. This is kind of a meditation. When I do my makeup, it takes time and I have to focus and I don't think about anything else.
Right.
So we all, you know, find our ways. So, I mean, to be a body positive activist, to be an eating disorders activist, you don't need... It's not about not caring about yourself. On the contrary, it's valuing yourself and caring about yourself, but not being obsessed and thinking that your value is only based on that. So if I want to talk about my self-esteem pie, physical appearance has a place there, but definitely the work I do with my patients has a much bigger place. Okay. And definitely the type of mother I am with my children and how well they're doing or not has a huge impact on me. Physical appearance is a part, but it's not definitely it's one of the smallest parts. So these are things I discuss openly with my patients when they do ask.
Well, to your point earlier, right, if you're not doing this type of self-care and your own sort of psychological, I'm going to call it treatment, but, you know, how can you help others, right? It becomes...
And I do therapy. I'm someone who underwent therapy. So I'm a big therapy believer. I believe in therapy. I did during my studies, and then every 10 years I go and I speak to someone, and I have a supervisor. So I'm constantly also working on myself, because I can't help anyone if I'm not in a good place myself.
Yeah, I can't emphasize this enough. I mean, I am personally also a big fan of therapy, and I have done my own therapy, especially since my parents' death, and something I speak about openly. And I have found it hugely positive over the years. And one of the things that has helped me personally a lot, that I felt, of course, you know, so two things. One is there's a bit of that stigma if you start doing therapy, even for many years, that all your problems are going away. Of course not.
Of course not. We don't have a magic wand.
That's right. There's still some demons that you have to conquer on a daily basis.
And new
basis
things that
come up.
That
life
come
life
up.
Throws things at
yeah,
you.
Yeah, like COVID, like Lebanese people and all the traumas they've had to live. No one, you know, was expecting 100%. That.
But what I did find, one of the main contribution for me, at least personally, has been the level of introspection. So when I look at myself, I hope, 10 years ago versus today, I feel that my level of introspection has gone up. Even when I make mistakes, by mistakes I mean if I treat someone in a way that I don't think I should have, or made a mistake in human judgment error in my day-to-day life, I am far more aware of it than I used to. I also am more aware of my triggers, actions, things that I do, activities, and people that are around me, which is something I was completely unaware of in my teens and 20s and so on. Do you see that generally being...
Yes, this is the most important part in therapy, specifically, you know, when you work in depth on your issues. The whole idea is to gain insight into your own functioning, how you're reacting to things, and eventually try to change. But already the level of awareness, if you have a good level of awareness, if you see what you're doing and you see what it's causing you and you know what are your triggers, it's even if you don't change yet, it's already huge. And it will, you know, it will definitely with time lead to a change in behavior, and it will definitely lead in time to in protecting yourself. So knowing where not to put yourself to avoid being triggered.
Excellent. Thank you, Karine. I have one final question for you.
Sure.
Resources, any resources, easy resources you can recommend by ways of apps, books, references for people that want to just start on that journey? Because I felt, again, from my personal experience, that not everyone is ready immediately to see a therapist. Some might want to explore themselves at home. Are there any particular books or apps that you'd recommend?
So first, I'd like to talk two minutes about our association, MIDA.
Sure, please.
It's a big resource for anyone in the region suffering from an eating problem.
What does MIDA stand for?
The Middle East Eating Disorders Association. So you can find us online. It's an online platform.
Sure.
www.mida.me.
Okay, and we'll add it to the show notes.
Contact us through info@mida.me.
Okay.
So basically, for anyone who has an eating problem or anyone who's caring for someone who has an eating problem, there's a lot of resources. There are. We have a hotline, so if you send an email, someone, an expert will speak to you.
Okay.
And
very helpful. Thank you.
We'll guide you. We offer 15 minutes free consultation online also to guide patients, etc. There's a lot of books. There's a lot of resources for parents, for carers.
Is it anonymous? Okay.
Completely anonymous.
Okay, that's helpful. So this
is one. In general, again, all the positive psychology homework, I think, are extremely good. So there's an app called the 5-Minute Journal, which is like it forces you every morning to write 5 things you feel grateful for and what you look forward to in life today.
I do 3 things. I feel like now you make me feeling guilty. I need to go back and add 2 every day. It's going to be a problem.
3 things.
Please tell me 3.
It's amazing. And then 5 things, what went well today also, like, you know, be feeling...
At the end of the day.
At the end of the day, what I did well today, things like that. I love the meditation apps. There's Headspace, which is very good. There's Calm, which has lots of, specifically for sleep, they have sleep stories and things like that that can help sleep. There is also, you know, if you have an eating problem, Overcoming Binge Eating is a very, very good book, even if you have anorexia, because it's going to give you general guidelines on, you know, the physiology of your body, etc. And you can put my email if anyone wants to contact me for any
Was my last question. Where to find you? Is it on email? What's the best way to find you? Is it on Twitter? Email?
On Twitter. My account is public, so people can follow me on Twitter. My email, and I work at the American Center for Psychiatry and Neurology.
We hope to have Dr. Karine back soon to unpack more on mental health and disorders, as there's a lot more ground to cover. Thank you for joining us on the Lighthouse Conversations this week. I'm Hesham Montasser, and our producer is Chirag Desai. You can connect with us on Instagram at thelighthouse_AE. We love hearing from you, and if you want to check out older episodes, go to our website at thelighthouse.ae/podcast. We'll see you in 2 weeks.